Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's football finance expert, Kieran Maguire. And Kieran, if it sounds like there's a spring in my step, it's because autumn's on the way and because your game against Chelsea had 2,500 fans in attendance yesterday. I imagine the car park must have been full of Audis.
It was indeed. Some of them with ambient lighting dashboards as well, no doubt, in the new Audi A3.
That'll teach those people that say we can't act properly. Did you go, by the way?
No, I was working.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately, so I would have gone. I was watching it on a stream whilst working. Yeah, it's like keeping one eye on the match.
Yeah, of course. But it's just very encouraging that there were people back watching football again, and even I smiled at a photograph of the Brighton ground. So let's hope that's the start of something beautiful. Kieran, it's Questions Day, but one of our news stories has many sub-clauses. It's a very big story, so I suspect we may not get to all our questions. So Matthew Honeyman, Mike Bernardi, Andrew Wilson, Dave Parker and Colin Telford, you may have to wait another week. That's a very different pod, isn't it? You may have to wait another. You can mate whenever you want, but you may have to wait another week. If so, apologies in advance. Please keep listening and not mating. This first story, Kieran, has gone under the radar pretty much outside most of South East London, but disgruntled Charlton fans are so fed up, they've actually occupied the Valley's stands and boardrooms. And disgruntled Charlton fans is a tautology, obviously, but this is a big step forward, isn't it?
It is. I think they're taking a non-violent, direct action approach, which I applaud. Yeah, they have been quite innovative in their protests against previous owners. I think it's always quite good to appear on this show once, but when it's once a fortnight, you normally know there's a series of bad news coming round, and unfortunately, Charlton are appearing far too regularly at present. This is in respect of the present owners, who are East Street Investments, owned by Tanoon Niguer and Matt Southall. And they bought the club for £1 in, I think it was December. Yeah. So what the Charlton fans have done is that they managed to get access to the ground. They invaded the boardroom and they stuck up a giant photograph of a pound coin, and they've been dropping pound coins outside the ground, effectively saying our pound is worth far more than yours. The club has lurched from crisis to crisis over the last few months. The EFL, to give them some credit here, they have rejected the new potential owners. I think that they've identified there's an element of frying pan and fire in respect of some of the potential people that are trying to buy the club. And again, Charlton fans, non-violent, direct action. They invaded the offices of one of the potential owners who's been on the naughty boys list of the EFL. They are hoping that Thomas Sandgaard, who is the Danish guy based in the States, is going to come in and sort this out. But his view, I think, is that if he buys the club, he wants to buy everything. Presently, you've got Roland de Chachelet owning the stadium and the training ground. You've got somebody else owning effectively the share of the club, which means that they're part of the EFL and therefore the squad and things of that nature. And my real concern is that Charlton end up like Leeds or Portsmouth and become part of a gigantic pass-the-parcel activity. We're hoping to get Thomas Sangard on the show if he does take over. So it'll be interesting to see what his plans are. So I've been in contact with him. So, you know, hope he's a good guy. And there's no reason to think why that shouldn't be the case. And B, he can put this to bed. I mean, certainly reading what he's had to say up to date, you know, he does appear to understand the views of the fans.
Yeah, and we know as well, Kieran, historically, when Charlton fans get involved, things tend to happen. You know, back in the day when they started their own political party to get them back to the Valley, and that was a great success. So maybe this is what it finally needs. This is the line in the sand that the fans have drawn, and let's hope that it's more positive from now on. And we'll try and talk to the potential new owner when he does take over. In the meantime, if any of the Charlton organisers want to speak to us, we'll happily do that as well. Now, Our old friend, in inverted commas, Bury owner Steve Dale, has posted, shall we say, interesting update on the club's website. And I think one thing we can say, Kieran, there are no algorithms possible to get that upgraded to beyond a C-. Because, I mean, it's astonishingly badly written. But can you summarise what he said without using the word scumbag or wrong-un? Because we've got sponsors now, remember.
Right. Well, this was a... This was a posting. It started off with a 62-word sentence. It had random use of capitals, and he can't spell. But Steve Dale claims to have a master plan where he's going to build a team from the bottom up. He's going to have a youth team and a first team. He's going to apply to play football somewhere. We don't know where in 2021-22. So on the basis of that, he's going to organise monthly friendlies. Now, I don't know where these are going to take place because I suspect the council won't give a licence for football to take place at Gig Lane. He's also claiming he's going to open the social club. So, you know, that would appear to be sort of, you know, sort of just on the right side of sane. But then we have to question what happened afterwards. He then goes on to criticise Joy Hart, who is the fan who famously handcuffed herself to the stadium when the EFL were about to destroy the club last year and expel it from the EFL. He criticises the local paper, the Bury Times. Now, I've read the Bury Times a lot, A, because I lived in Manchester most of my life, but B, you know, the Bury story was quite a big one. He criticises the EFL. He criticises the local council. And then he goes on to criticise Greater Manchester Police, claiming that they've effectively stiffed the club by taking money for when police officers attend matches, which, you know, they should be paid. You know, you do a job. So that was... That wasn't very pleasant. Then he completely lost the plot. He went on to launch into a diatribe against the BBC, something to do with licence fees being wrong for old people. That's nothing to do with the BBC. That decision was made by the Chancellor. And he then claimed that the BBC was using the licence fee to buy executive cars. Now, whether or not that includes the A3 with ambient lighting, I don't know. But he's launching that. And then he decided to launch into a criticism of Land and Hope and Glory not being sung at the proms, and said next they'll be trying to ban hymns and the Bible.
Mm. Yeah, it's an astonishing piece of injured innocence. I couldn't read it, Farfra. I mean, I thought his attack on Joy Hart, somebody who was willing to do that to save her club, was astonishing. But it just degenerates into basically gammon, you know, everyone's against this nonsense. And it's there's nothing there. And he has a go at the people who want to run other Bury clubs, saying they've got nothing to do with Bury. There's nothing there that would fill the heart of any Steve Dale loyalist with hope, is there? I mean, it's just... And as for the last night of the problems thing, it's just, you know, people can't sing it because they're not in the building, basically. Singing, it's just, never mind. But it's,
and he finished off by quoting Voltaire, which I just thought was a work of genius.
Well, that, I mean, that was a kind of... That's like seeing a really bad footballer do some keepy-uppies as he comes off the pitch at the end. I mean, that was the final flourish. That was, anyway, there's Wigan, again, and... There's bad news and good news for Wigan. The bad news, I presume, is that Wigan administrators have sold the training ground to Preston. But they've also said they're confident they will have a deal ready so that the club can start the new season. And that deal could include the fans, because Caroline Molyneux, as you may recall, who gave us a brilliant interview, she's the chair of the supporters club, contacted us last night to say they're close to raising £500,000 by tonight to buy a share in the club.
That's superb news. Yeah. I mean, the administrators, they sold the training ground. Wigan apparently have two training grounds, one of which is quite good, one of which isn't. So the one that they've sold to Preston North End owner, or it could be Preston North End Football Club, I'm not quite sure, that went for £1.6 million. The administrators have also sold quite a few of the players, which does make me a little bit twitchy in relation to how are Wigan going to fare in League One next season, though I imagine most Ticks fans will be just pleased to have a football club to support. The asking price for the club is £4 million. So it looks as if Wigan supporters and Caroline could be getting, you know, a 10% share. Mm-hmm. Now, if they do get £4 million for it, and they do seem to be reasonably confident of doing so, that would remove the 15-point penalty that you get if you don't pay your creditors 25% of what they're due. Mm-hmm. Now, within that £4 million is £3 million. That is the value of the stadium. And I think we ought to keep that in mind when we go on to some of our further stories.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, it would be wonderful if Wigan supporters were to get a share in the club. But obviously, that's purely down to the new owners wanting them to have a share, isn't it? I mean, the administrators won't be compulsorily forced to let them have a share, will they? I mean, if somebody comes along and says, I've got the money to buy the club, I don't want the fans involved, then the administrators will take that offer, won't they?
That's correct. I mean, the administrators are legally obliged to accept the single biggest offer. They did say that they felt they had a good bidder earlier, but that was on the proviso that they'd stay in the Championship, which was why Wigan had the appeal. Mm. The good news is that they have managed to pay the August salaries, and they've got enough money now from the sale of players and the sale of the training ground to guarantee the September salaries. But therefore the 31st of August deadline has effectively been kicked a little bit further into the grass, with the administrators hoping to sell. But there is no guarantee, as you rightly said, Kevin, that the new owners would either A, accept, or B, want fan involvement in terms of a minority share.
Yeah, we will get Caroline back on the show if they do get their wish and get a share in the club. Is there a scenario, Kieran, and you know this as you were an administrator and you know the law, that's why I'm asking you a question. If they don't get a new owner by the time the season starts, could the administrators then ask the supporters for the £500,000 they've raised to help keep the club going till they do find an owner?
Well, they could certainly ask, or as we saw earlier on in the summer, the money which was raised by the supporters group was effectively donated to the club for overheads, which didn't include player wages.
Right.
So, yeah, ultimately, it will come down to the decision made by the fans group and the administrators as to whether they can get around the table. I mean, we don't know how much the administrators have sold players for. There's now been quite a few. One lad, I think, went to Leeds for £1 million. I think we've signed somebody from them for £500,000. So there's some, you know, decent fees to cover some of those overheads, which A, reduces the wage bill, and of course, B, gives the administrators money to cover ongoing costs.
Obviously, that's a story we'll keep an eye on. Now, this is the story that may eat into question time. Derby fans, I owe you an apology. I promised you nights full of sleep and rest and calm. I may have been premature. Now, I know, because a little baroness told me, that you spent around 48 hours looking over the EFL report into the Derby County case. They were cleared of all charges, but there is a bee buzzing in your bonnet. So let's go through it, not in nearly as much detail as you did, because we've only got an hour. and I don't want the Baroness having a go at me for you not turning up for dinner. What would so? There's a few questions. I've broken this down into questions on your request because otherwise you said it'd be a monologue. What were the charges from the EFL, first of all, specifically?
Right. The charges were that Derby County Football Club, when it sold Pride Park Stadium to a company called Gellor Nuco 202 for £81 million, that the stadium wasn't worth £81 million. Now, let's just go back to our previous story. The Wigan administrators are looking for £3 million quid for the DW Stadium. So, you know, I'm not a surveyor, so I'm not qualified to comment. It did seem slightly unusually high. But Mel Morris, the new owner, the owner of Gellor Nuco, who just coincidentally happens to be the owner of Derby County Football Club, said he was going to convert it into a multi-use stadium with a covered roof. Wow. So therefore, you know, perhaps have the Foo Fighters and Taylor Swift appearing there as part of their next world tour.
Yeah, there's a little insight into your musical taste there, isn't there? It covers a lot of bases. So was the club totally cleared of all these charges then?
It was. I mean, the other charge was in relation to this amortisation breaking the rules. And to a certain extent, in my view, Derby County could be seen to be the Pythagoras of amortisation in they that they've effectively said the world is round where everybody else thinks it's flat. They've come up with a very cunning scheme, as Baldrick would say, which managed to reduce the amortisation cost by £30 million in the 3 years to June 2018. And, you know, if the auditors have signed off on that, then, well, so be it. The EFL protested that the scheme wasn't acceptable. But the judgment was in the favour of the football club, although they did say that the accounts in relation to this particular issue were, and I quote, at very least ambiguous and, in reality, incomplete and inaccurate.
Hmm. Do we by chance know which football team the independent partner who audited the club's accounts supports?
Well, I went to take a look at the auditors, and they clearly, you know, and this is not, you know, this is what the critics have said, not what we are saying, of course. The critics have said that there's been a bit of a very close relationship between the two parties, because this firm of accountants, Smith Cooper, first of all, they help advise Mel Morris when taking over the club, perfectly entitled to that. He then appointed them as auditors, perfectly entitled to do that. They are one of the club sponsors. They did have naming rights to one of the stands, and the auditor in charge describes himself, this is Mr. James Delve, describes himself as a passionate Derby County supporter. Mm. Now, that's fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But, you know, critics have said, well, surely that calls into question the independence of the auditors, given that they were, you know, advised on the takeover, they are sponsors, they had the naming rights, they've acted for Mel Morris for more than 20 years. Does this mean that they're going to be fairly friendly when it comes to an accounting approach which has helped to increase profits by £30 million over the 3 years for the financial fair play period? There's no smoking gun on that.
Mm-hmm. A friend of ours and a friend of the show, Neil Baskerville, got in touch, and he was one of a fair few people who asked whether the Derby way, as you've described it in the past, was to use, for want of a better word, creative accounting to get into the Premier League, whereby the problem goes away.
Well, the problem does sort of go away. I mean, we have seen Queen's Park Rangers, to a certain extent, but Bournemouth and Leicester City take the approach that if they take a slightly more relaxed approach to the profitability and sustainability rules, then they get promoted and they really can't be touched by the EFL when the club is in the Premier League. And in relation to Leicester and Bournemouth, they both were fined, and the fines did run into millions of pounds. But again, the critics will say, well, we'll hold on a minute. If you look at the millions, hundreds of millions of pounds that both clubs have earned as a result of being promoted, the fines amounted to nothing more than a slap of the wrist. And if you take a look and see what Derby have done, their wage bill was £12 million in 2013, but it quadrupled in 5 years to £47 million because Derby were trying to sign the players to get them promoted. And again, if you look at their player purchases, in the 3 years before Mel Morris took over, they spent £14 million. In the first 3 years after, that figure had gone up to 66. Now, to me, that's a sign of an owner that wants to get his club promoted. Mm. And I'm that's not a criticism. I think all owners want that.
What's Mel Morris had to say since the being cleared of all the charges?
Well, I think it's fair to say he was pretty unhappy. He accused the EFL of having an agenda against him. He described himself as being an enemy of the EFL state. And that they've got an axe to grind against him personally. These are quite cross comments. Now, it could be that he feels that he's done nothing wrong, and on the basis of the IDC verdict, he's fine to do that. I've got to be honest, the EFL, they're just carrying on their duties. That they don't have a personal like or dislike of any one individual.
Finally, I mean, we could be here all day talking about this report, Kieran, and I know in an ideal world you would be, except I can just hear the Baroness's foot tapping from here. But there's one detail which really quite startled me, because obviously I haven't read it. Middlesbrough appeared 51 times in this report. Why was that?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Middlesbrough owner Steve Gibson and Mel Morris aren't the best of friends. So Middlesbrough certainly had a lot of correspondence with the EFL with regards to this. At one stage, they were threatening a private prosecution. The EFL, to their credit, says, look, hold on, we're the body in charge of football as far as these 71/72 clubs are concerned. Please let us get on with it. And Middlesbrough were sort of eventually persuaded to not launch that private prosecution. But I think the Middlesbrough versus Derby championship match this year, if that's being televised, I think my camera would be on the director's box rather than what's happening on the pitch.
To end, Kieran, just so Derby fans don't think that we have a personal axe to grind, why is it important for football that we talk about this in detail?
Well, as fans, I think we're entitled to some form of transparency. Derby won because, first of all, I've got to be honest, the EFL legislation is poor.
Right.
It allows clubs to sell their stadia. It doesn't say that amortization has to be on a straight line basis. Derby had an excellent legal team. I know I've mentioned this guy's name before, but their head QC, a guy called Nick DeMarco. He's the type of guy, in my view, if you've got a puppy in a locked room sat next to a big lump of poo, Nick DeMarco would get the puppy off being accused of doing the poo. He's that good. So they got an excellent team. And also the EFL's witnesses, their expert witnesses, were pretty rubbish. They had a valuer who compared Pride Park to Morecambe and St Helens rugby ground when doing his valuation. I'm not saying it happens to be my club. If you're looking at the value of a modern stadium, well, there's one in Brighton which is same size as Derby's, and it costs £91 million. So, yeah, that gives you a rough idea of perhaps what something would cost. When he valued it, he valued it on the basis of Derby's average attendance, ignoring the capacity of the ground. Is a bit like saying, I'm going to value a house which has five bedrooms on two bedrooms because three of them aren't being used very often. So it just did seem to be a bit crazy. And the other expert witness that they had, a guy called Professor Pope, which sounds to me like somebody from Cluedo, the commission described him as being unfamiliar with the duties of an expert witness. Now, you know, excuse me, if you're an expert witness, you're supposed to be an expert. You should know what a witness is expected to be able to do. Mm. So, you know, it's a bit like having the Chuckle Brothers on your side. You know, and as much as I love the Chuckle Brothers, God rest the soul of one of them, it's probably not going to get you very far in a court.
Mm. Yeah, but if you want somebody to step in a bucket, they'd be ideal. I'll be perfectly honest, I was a bit distracted in the last minute or two of that as I was trying to work out how Nick DeMarco would get the puppy off the charge without claiming that he'd done the poo himself. But that's, again, that's for another day. So good news for the people whose questions are at the end. We're only 25 minutes in, so we may get to you. But our first question, Kieran, is from Neil Penfold. And it's a simple question, but an interesting one. Neil Penfold asks whether the League One and League Two salary cap should be a flat limit that applies to all clubs or a ratio of a club's turnover.
Right. Flat or soft caps, that they both have some merits. The EFL in League One, they have gone for what's referred to as the flat cap, which means that there's a squad spend of 2.5 million in League One and 1.5 million in League Two. It does level the playing field. It does give the likes of Accrington Stanley and Rochdale Football Club a greater chance of being promoted. And part of me thinks, well, that's actually quite good news. There is a danger, I think, that if you're a club that is presently under the cap, rather than being good for your wages, it could be, and this is an issue that I have with the Baroness and our credit card, is that the limit becomes a target. And therefore, if you're spending 2 million on wages at present, the agent's coming, so, well, look, guys, you could spend 2.5. My player wants a pay rise.
Yeah.
So you have to be a little bit careful with that. There are loopholes, is too harsh a word. There are exemptions to the cap, which we've discussed before. So it has some merits. The soft cap, which is a percentage of income, clearly that does favour the bigger clubs, the likes of Portsmouth, Ipswich and Sunderland in League One, who have bigger crowds. And we see that in the Premier League. And you and I, we both support clubs who, at the start of the season, our first objective is to avoid relegation. You know, I suspect if we're honest with our listeners, neither of us are expecting to get into the Champions League this season.
Not this season, maybe. No, it might be a bit premature, but, you know, given our sudden desire to sign young people, who knows? Yes, no, you're absolutely right. You and I both, the first thing that happens when the fixtures come out is to make sure that we think we can finish above the three promoted clubs, basically, of course. Now, having said there was good news for the people who had questions at the end, this next question is slightly bad news because it's a very good one, but it's long. In an ideal world, this would be one to talk about around the pub table. The question comes from Liam Blaney. Now, Liam is a man of Kent, he says. Now, for overseas listeners and maybe some of the people here, I should explain that you are either a man of Kent or a Kentish man, depending which side of the River Medway you inhabit in that county. Obviously, in the olden days in Kent, a woman could live where she wanted. She was still just a woman, because it's very definitely man of Kent and Kentish man. But Liam says, this is a question that's always puzzled him. Why does a county the size of Kent only have one football club, Gillingham, while other counties in the north have many, many more? Surrey and Sussex are also fairly bereft. Is this down to historical trends and a proximity to London? And why have no wealthy investors in and around London taken advantage of this potential opportunity? And do local football associations provide funding to professional clubs? Now, Kieran, I can answer the first question a little bit if I leave the financial ones to you, because back in the day, Liam, there were a lot of clubs in counties like Surrey and Sussex. The very first meeting of the FA in 1863, for example, had Blackheath, which was from Kent, also Crystal Palace, which was from Kent, Surbiton FC from Surrey. And in the 1880s, there were more than 40 clubs in Shropshire that were affiliated to the FA. But what tended to happen is that in the south, which was dominated by the gentlemen and public schoolboys of the FA who didn't like competition and didn't like the idea of professionalism. In fact, one club in Hampshire was kicked out of the FA for training. They were caught training. The FA thought this was terribly close to professionalism. But in the north, of course, where you had a captive audience And the government eventually changed the law so that work had to stop in factories and mills at 1 o'clock on a Saturday, which is why we have 3 o'clock kickoffs. And the factory and mill owners decided to invest in football teams to get the workers from their factory into their football teams, and basically, ostensibly, were professional. They paid money to get players down from Scotland. So by the time the league was formed itself in 1888, they were all northern teams. So in the south, basically, most of the teams fell away because there was no competition, and you ended up with the big towns in the counties being, you know, Gillingham, Swindon, Shrewsbury, people like that. So other versions of that history are available, but that's the reason. There used to be clubs all over those counties, and that's the reason why there aren't now. But the financial questions, Kieran, are very interesting. Why have no wealthy investors had a look round at clubs like Gillingham and thought, this is close to London, this could be a gold mine?
It's because I think, A, they'd rather invest in London itself because of the joys of being in the capital. If you take a look at the population of these towns, the three largest towns in Kent, we've got Maidstone, who, remember, were a football league club.
I remember them beating us at Sellers Park.
Yep. They've got a population of 113,000. Gillingham's 104. Dartford is 87. And then it sort of drops away quite a lot. So is there a sufficient support? So if you are a wealthy owner, are you going to be able to generate a support base which will fund that club in the longer term? Mm. And would it actually be cheaper to go and buy Charlton, you know, something of that nature, or even Palace? Because you can buy a ready-made club with a ready-made ground, with a ready-made support for a bit more, and you don't have to go through... you know, if we've decided to, you know, invest £100 million into Dartford Football Club, how many years is it going to take to get to, you know, a standard where you're going to get some form of return on your investment, not financially, but in terms of getting the kudos and the TV appearances that you crave?
Mm. Gillingham had the hump with Charlton for quite a few seasons a while ago, because Charlton started running free coaches from Medway Towns to Charlton games, and Gillingham thought that was unfair, eating into their fan base. But the final part of that question was one that I never thought of before. Do local FAs have any say in professional teams? So would the Kent FA have any investment or say in Gillingham Football Club?
No, none at all, because we've got the three governing bodies effectively in football, which is the Football Association, the Premier League and the EFL. So therefore, Gillingham fall within the umbrella of the EFL. If anything, the Kent FA would be keener to support, you know, the likes of the clubs of Dartford and Maidstone and those, you know, Royal Tunbridge Wells and so on, because that's the people that actually sit on the committees of the Kent FA. I mean, the only way they do get financial support is through the FA Trophy, the FA Cup and the VARs.
Right, okay. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level is, for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, It's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Now, our next question comes from a regular listener and a regular question asker, actually, Christopher Habib. Christopher says, in today's world, does a footballer need an agent? I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he talks about reading Ian Wright's book when he said he'd rather have a solicitor who takes a couple of hours to look at a contract compared to paying an agent 20% for 5 years to keep looking at the contract.
No, there's no obligation to have an agent. I mean, what we are finding with some agents, and remember we had Jonathan on, who was an agent a good few months ago on the show, is you've got to look at the level of service provided by the agent, and there's sort of basic, advanced, and premium. And some agents, they will effectively run your life for you. They'll run your bank account. They'll pay your bills. They will organise your MOT on your car, and or not the football ever have a car more than 3 years old, and so on. Yeah. And for that, they effectively charge a management fee for the basic services offered by agents. It would just be potentially perhaps a cut of the transfer fee, and the player might either pay him a fixed amount or an agreed amount. It could be just of his first year's salary. In the lower leagues and things of that nature. So some agents do very well, a lot depends upon who the agent's representing. And if you are an elite player, you don't have the time to go through the small print of the 200 emails that get sent to your on a daily basis by people who want your signature or your face next to a product. So therefore you rely on the agent and your management team to sort out the good from the bad in terms of those offers.
Chris Whiffin, which is probably my favorite name of the day, Chris. Chris has a question about Championship newcomers Wycombe Wanderers. Chris says he's had a look. I don't know how, but Chris has had a look and he can't find anywhere how much money the new owner has injected into Wycombe. What are their finances like and how much cash will Gareth Ainsworth be able to spend this season?
Right. The new owner is a guy called Rob Kuhig. Wycombe lost £667,000 in 2018, £869,000 in 2019. They were owned by the trust. My understanding, having been in contact with somebody connected with the trust, was that they were genuinely worried about the club going out of business, and this was pre-COVID. Right. So what this guy, who's is an American lawyer, has done, he's come in and he's effectively covered the costs for the rest of 2019-20. Wycombe's cost under Gareth Ainsworth, that squad cost zero. Yeah, it was all free transfers,
wow,
apprentices and so on. So you've got to give Gareth Ainsworth a huge amount of credit when you compare them to the likes of Ipswich, Pompey and Sunderland, yeah, who we mentioned earlier, who have spent big sums. There is no evidence of how much money the club will have to spend next season. All I would say is that Wycombe's TV money goes up from £1.5 million to £7 million. So, you know, how much of that Rob Kuhig is going to give to Gareth Ainsworth, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, and they're a club as well who will be desperate to get the fans back, because you'll remember from the old day. I mean, Wycombe have got a surprisingly big fan base considering where they're based, and away from home they take a lot of fans as well. So they'll be missing out. Well, I suppose, people are still buying merchandise, aren't they? So, I mean, but hopefully, we're assuming it will be one season in the Championship, but that could be enough to secure their future for 2, 3, 4 years.
Yep. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, certainly the last time I was there, it was an enjoyable trip, a Glenn Murray hat trick. So both of us can cheer that one on, Kevin.
Well, why would I cheer a hat trick for Glenn Murray for your team?
Murray?
Yeah, no.
Glenn Murray transcends sport.
When he's playing for your team, he's Glenn Murray with a small G and a small M. He's not Glenn Murray. Glenn Entwistle is a Blackburn fan, and he adds, someone has to be. Now, Glenn, none of that. I don't want that sort of talk. Stand proud. You support a very famous historical team. But I really like this question because I think we've all been through this. Glenn says him and his mate, and he's not going to name his mate, but he says him and his mate grew up in the big spending Jack Walker years. And his mate says that given Man City's recent victory over UEFA, Blackburn should just let the Venkies buy their way back to the Premier League. Now, Glenn says he's tried to explain countless times that UEFA and EFL rules are very different, but his mate won't have it. So can we explain it to him? I really feel for Glenn because we've all got a mate that simply won't believe that a taxi driver doesn't have to hold his cape around a pregnant woman while she has a wee. So we've all got mates like that. I just go, no, it's true. Dane Bowers told me. I know. It's, yeah. So can we help Glenn here?
You and your showbiz pals.
Yeah. I won't tell you what Dane Bowers claimed once about policemen, but it definitely wasn't true. We told him not to try it. But can we help Glenn talk his mate round?
In terms of trying to buy promotion, actually, we've already said, you know, Leicester and Bournemouth and QPR, they all did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, it can be done. The trouble is, what happens if you spend the money, or I think the word our Prime Minister would use would be spaff the money against a wall, and it doesn't work out. And in that, I give you Stoke City 2018-19.
Yeah, yeah.
Stoke City had a £56 million wage bill. They spent £67 million on Afobe, Clocus, Etobu, Tom Ince, don't know whether his mum came along as well, and James McLean. And they finished 16th.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was £123 million on player signings and wages, and it got them 16th. So it's fine if it works and you get out of that division. Yeah. When it doesn't work, you end up like Aston Villa did under Tony G. You end up with Stoke. I mean, Stoke is fortunate in the sense that they have owners who are multi-billionaires. So therefore, if they lose money, it's not a problem for them. But Stoke now have had to make some significant cutbacks in expenditure in order to comply with FFP. So if you say, sod it, we're going to spaff this year and it works, then that's great. If it doesn't, you're left with your pants down.
Yeah, I felt so. I've got a couple of mates who support Stoke, and that season, not only were they spending that money, but that was a season they tried to change from being a long ball team to a passing team, and it didn't quite come off. It was like watching a werewolf get stuck halfway. It wasn't pleasant to watch. So I mean, obviously, Glenn's right. The EFL rules and the UEFA rules are different, aren't they, in terms of FFP?
They are to a certain extent. I mean, they set different targets. I mean, the broad principles are the same, is that they set a limit on your losses over a 3-year period. And both of them act in hindsight. And I think that's part of the problem in that until we have some, this was one of the issues that Damien Collins raised when we interviewed him on Thursday, until you have real time monitoring of clubs overspending, then you can't actually sort of act during the season. Though, you know, I'll be the first to admit, I think the EFL would have a really tough job in doing that. And yeah, it's not what we go to football for.
No, that's true. Our next question, and I've got good news. We might not get to Colin Telford, but I think we'll get as far as Dave Parker. Our next question comes from Robert Jan Viverberg. Now, I really hope I spelt it correctly as I've copied it down. I'm good at spelling, actually. I hope I pronounced that properly. I when I was doing my notes last night, during a bottle of wine, I thought I've got enough pub Dutch to be able to pronounce that properly, but I lost confidence just as you were answering the last question. So I do hope, Robert, that I pronounced that correctly. If not, feel free to tweet like everybody else does. Robert's question is an interesting one. Everybody's question is interesting, but his question is around the building of new football stadiums. Robert says, I realise this is an emotionally charged subject, yep, but given the enormous costs involved, Brentford apparently spent £71 million on their new stadium, and the fact that they'll only be used once every 2 weeks, why aren't more, and he specifies London football clubs, building and sharing new stadia together? Are emotions overweighing financial benefits here again? Yep. It's a fair point, though, because QPR have been after a new ground for ages. And just down the road, Brentford have built a new ground. Why at any stage did QPR not talk to Brentford? And I know it's different abroad, but, you know, Milan share a club. They didn't hate each other when they started sharing a stadium all those decades ago, did they?
That's right. Well, I mean, you know from your own experience, you've shared with both Charlton and Wimbledon.
Well, no, they've shared with us. I'll stop you there. And we didn't share with, they shared with us, and very, still very much didn't stop them being ungrateful bastards all the way through. But carry on. This, you know, it seemed that offering to share our ground and keep them out of financial difficulty was not a decent gesture after all. But there you go.
Well, and we've done the same at Gillingham, and we hate Gillingham for that as well, because also down during that period, Charlton were advertising in Brighton. Why travel all the way to Gillingham to go and watch your team? We'll offer you. They were offering free buses for Brighton fans to go and support Charlton, which for some still rankles,
of course, because
we're football fans. Yeah. We don't forget ever. It's part of your identity, your football ground. You've said this in the past, and I've said, certainly when we're at the Goldstone, you've said the same about Selhurst. It may be a bit of a dump, but it's our dump.
I
think that emotional issue is absolutely critical. It means that if it was a municipal stadium, or if we were sharing, if you were sharing with somebody else, and it was a crap Tuesday night, and you're playing Burnley, you might think twice about going, because I'm not going to Selhurst. What people forget is that they assume that going to a football match is just walking to a stadium and walking home again. It's not that. For you, it's the Pawson's Arms. For you, it's sitting next to those same guys. Yeah. For you, it's meeting all your mates before the match. That is the football experience, which non-football fans, I think, at times don't quite get as part of British football culture.
I'm welling up now. I really miss it. I really suddenly miss Selhurst Park so much. To answer one part of Robert's question as well, though, and this is something we've always argued, that most clubs, most stadia, and this is changing, it shouldn't be used only once every 2 weeks. It should be open and available every day to the community for all sorts of things. I'm so missful. Matthew Honeyman starts his question by saying, I'm a Hull City fan for my sins. Now, people, I can't say this enough. Stop apologising for who you support. The only person who needs to do that is Kieran. Matthew, I've subbed your question a little bit. I hope you don't mind. You can blame Derby if you want. Matthew's question basically is, Hull are currently repaying a loan from the owner at 4% interest. The owner has asked for £40 million to sell the club, even though they don't own their own stadium. £40 million seems a lot. Relegation will bring a massive loss of revenue. So Matthew's question, is there a way this can end without the Alams, the owners, completely hollowing out the club to get their money back? And before you answer the question, Kieran, it's almost considering what the Alams tried to do to the club at the start, and the same with the Venkis to an extent, it's almost a miracle that those people are still owning those clubs in the first place, to be able to have this question asked about them, isn't it?
Yeah, they're not the most popular. I think they turned down £100 million when Hull were in the Premier League, so that they're probably feeling a bit sore. My understanding is that £40 million asking price has now been reduced to around about half of that price, because, of course, they've been relegated to League One. Yeah. And they also sold a couple of players in January. So it could be that a prospective new owner could get the club at a substantially lower fee. A lot will revolve around the KC Stadium. That is owned by a company called Super Stadium Management Co. Limited, which is also owned by the Alams. And that rents out the stadium to Hull AFC Football Club, not Hull City Tigers Limited, as the Alams have rather provocatively called the company which owns the football club, and Hull FC of Super League. So I think, again, going back to what we were talking about in respect of Charlton and Thomas Sangard, when you buy the club, you want to buy the whole bundle together. Yeah. So it, given that Hull are starting the season in League One, and given that the Alams should have got back some of their loans from the sale of those players in January, they could come out of it effectively getting their money back, and the new owners could buy it at a substantially reduced fee.
Yeah, the current owners, I mean, they really alienated the fans when they tried to change the name to Hull Tigers. And the fans have been voting with their feet recently. But I would have thought this was a decent prospect for any owner. I mean, it's a proper one-town club. I mean, I know they have to compete with two big rugby league clubs, but they'll fill that stadium if they're in the Premier League or if they're doing well in the Championship. So there's money to be made out of, God forbid that I said that, but there is money to be made out of buying a club like Hull, isn't there?
I think they're a club with potential, absolutely. And they've been in the Premier League on a couple of occasions. So yeah, they've shown that they can get there historically. In terms of the stadium, it's not bog standard, to quote the expert from the EFL in respect of Derby Stadium. And Derby's isn't a bog standard stadium either. It's excellent. So I think there's lots of positives. And as you say, it's they've got a catchment area where they're not competing with other football clubs.
Mm. And I'm honour bound to say this whenever we mention Hull, white phone boxes. Although they're not white, they're cream. And they don't have a crown on the top either, like the phone boxes in the rest of the country, because of their anti-King stance in the Civil War. I admire that.
And they've got some fantastic bands. I was a huge fan of the Red Guitars, and the Luddites and so on. So, yeah, they've got a fantastic musical history.
Yeah, well done for not mentioning the House Martins, because they were one of my least favourite bands, mainly because of London Nil Hole 4. There's quite a few things that make me resentful for a long time. To quote the great Mark Lamar, I can forgive, but I can't forget or forgive. Andrew Wilson. Andrew Wilson has a question on the original Premier League TV deal and the split of the money within the leagues. Andrew says, is it correct that the Football League was offered up to 25% of that deal to approve it, but preferred to do its own deal? And if that is correct, English football could have looked very different had they not done so.
I've had a look at this. I can't find any such offer. When the Premier League was formed, or rather prior to when the Premier League was formed, the split was 50% to the top division, the old Division 1, 25% to Division 2, 12.5% to Division 3, and 12.5% to Division 4. What we now have is 86.3% going to the Premier League. And if you're in League 2, you get 0.7. So yeah, that's just indicative of the way things have become so skewed.
Yeah.
If the EFL were offered 25% at some point, so yeah, I've looked for it, I've not been able to find anything, I guess they would be feeling pretty sore at present. So you know, the Championship is getting half of what it used to, and the Leagues 1 and 2 are getting less than a tenth of the share of the football money, of the football broadcast pot, compared to 1992.
Right, I've got good news for Dave Parker and Colin Telford. I think we're going to get to both of them, actually, even though Colin's question really is one for a pint round a pub table. But Dave Parker, and I think Dave echoes the feelings of a lot of people, especially when we've been talking about Wigan recently. But Dave basically says, can you explain why the EFL deducts 12 points for clubs going into administration when you're giving a club in trouble even more problems?
Well, the aim is to try to be more carrot than stick, right, in the sense of, if clubs know that they will get an automatic 12-point deduction, and you know, we've looked at the morality surrounding the Wigan issue, but ultimately the EFL, I think, had little choice but to apply that deduction. If clubs know that they're going to get an automatic points deduction, then those club owners who had historically taken the view of, well, we're going to try to buy promotion, and if it doesn't work out, we'll just put the club into administration, buy it back from the administrators, and start all over again. Can you say that system, which did exist to a certain extent between 2002 to 2004, 13 administrations, 2005 to 7-6, 2008 to 2010-9. So, you know, just over that 8-year period, we had 28 football clubs going into administration. That was ludicrous, because the clubs were taking a cavalier approach to their finances. So as a consequence of the introduction of these rules, and I'll be the first to admit, because I was no fan of ITV Digital, that did cause problems for EFL clubs. It has led to fewer clubs going into administration as a result. And remember, it's not just the clubs, it's the clubs' creditors. It's the people that drive the coaches, provide the transport services. It's the people that supply the pies and the St. John's ambulance. They were the people that were getting stiffed all the time.
Yeah.
So we've got to think beyond just football.
Yeah, and also back in the day, sort of 2002 onwards, as you say, there was a spate of clubs waiting for the end of the season to go into administration, wasn't there? And then, as you say, because then there would be no penalty. If there was a penalty, it wouldn't count. So that's why the EFL sort of closed that loophole as well. So Colin Telford, well done for hanging on. Colin starts his question this way. Having listened to you for a while, and that's the sort of intro that could go both ways, frankly. that's the sort of thing when a teacher says, having listened to you for a while, oh my God. and well done for not saying anything when I said go both. I just realised I shouldn't say go both ways in front of you, should I? Colin says, Colin says, that's my fault, I shouldn't even have mentioned it. Colin says, you're obviously both romantics when it comes to football, but you're also aware of financial realities and the potential social good of football. Balancing all that, what do you think your clubs, so Palace and Brighton, should target as success, and what would bring you most joy? Well, most joy, I mean, success would be always being a division above Brighton. But that's, I think this is a really interesting question. And again, it's one of those why I said I'd rather answer this around a pub table with you and Colin. But also, I think age-wise, we asked this when we got in the FA Cup final in 2016. Our Palace Pod, FYP, said, would you rather win the FA Cup or stay in the Premier League? And I was amazed that so many fans said, I'd rather win the FA Cup, because in years to come, you won't be able to remember which season it was we finished 14th and which was 15th, but you'll always remember the FA Cup. But when we looked at it, it's almost split down the middle. It's age-wise. Older fans want to stay in the Premier League. Younger fans want to win stuff. So, I mean, success for us, Kieran, I think we're both in the same boat. 95% of the people listening to this would love to support a team that's in the Premier League, mid-table or not. So success for me at my age is having a club to support and a club that does its best to help the community, really. I mean, a trophy every now and again would be nice, but just being in the Premier League, I think, is a remarkable success compared to where we were in 2010, for example.
Yeah. And for me, you know, the results on the pitch, we finished, what, 15th last season? I'll tell you what, yeah, if we were mid-table, I'd be absolutely delighted. Yeah. You know, we've had relegation fights 2 years out of the last two. Mid-table, I think we'd be absolutely delighted. In terms of football romantics, why do we both go to football, Kevin? We enjoy the 90 minutes, but it's shared experiences, it's memories, it's friendship as well. You know, it's the people that I've met through supporting my club, like Big Dave, like Uncle Ian, you know, like Crispies and so on. You know, these complete lunatics who become part of your life and they stay part of your life, and I know that they're going to be with me until, you know, and we're all reaching a certain age, until we start to pop our clogs. And it gives you that identity. The football is sort of the central point through which all of that universe revolves.
Yeah, I'm welling up again, but I'm slightly worried about Uncle Ian, I have to say. was this a long lost uncle that you met through football? Or was this just...
Oh no, he's the uncle to at least 200 people that I'm aware of.
Okay, yeah, I always get slightly suspicious of a bloke in the pub who says, "Just call me uncle." Righto, fair enough. We'll leave it there. Thank you for all your questions today. They've been interesting and fascinating as ever. And we've kept it to below an hour. Guy will be pleased. Does Guy have to pay somebody overtime when we go above an hour? Because he's obsessed with the fact that we don't go above an hour.
I think he pays Guy overtime if we keep it under an hour.
Guy's got bonuses like Terry Venables used to have bonuses. He's got all angles covered, mate. If you want to ask us a question, and it could be as big or small as you want, questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, I will hand you over to Kieran for our final message.
Well, thanks again, folks, for all your feedback. Thanks for keeping us on our toes. If you could go across to that big purple icon on the Apple Podcast app and give us 5 stars, we appreciate it. It's not for us. You could write whatever you want. You could write it to Juvenile. You could write your favourite cheese on you want. You could write it would be better with the Swiss Ramble and Justin Morehouse. Yeah, we don't care, but it. According to producer Guy, it makes a difference. And apart from that, stay safe and look after yourselves.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.